Sadi Gaur Bhaktivinoda Ki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gaur Gopinath Sharanakunda Radha Kunda Guru Govardhana Ki Jai. Vrindavan Dham Ki Jai. Tura Dham Ki Jai. Navadvip Mayapur Dham Ki Jai. Jagannath Puri Dham Ki Jai. Gangamaya Jamuna Devi Ki Jai. Bhakti Devi Ki Jai. Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai. Samaveta Bhaktivinoda Ki Jai. Gaur Premananda. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Sri Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Sagadala Sri Mati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Yitinamane Namaste Sarasvati Devi Gauravani Pacharane Nivasasis Nivadi Paskatyade Satarane. Mande ham Shri Guru Shri Tapada Kamalam Shri Guru and Vaishnavam Shashi Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raganatam Vitam Sam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvajutam Purujana Sahita Krishna Chaitam Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lavita Shri Vishakam Vitam Shah Panchakapa Chudishaki Visindavya Vitapitanam Pavanevio Vaishnavi Vidamon. Pass these out to anyone who can read English. Can you all understand English? Everybody? Do you need any translation? So September 25th, 2014 in Goloka Dham, Germany. And we're going to be examining humility. So in the 13th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, texts 8 through 12, Krishna lists how one gets knowledge. And by knowledge, he doesn't mean how to go to Lithuania or how to change the battery in your car. But he means to understand what is truth. Who am I? What is God? What is the nature of matter? What is my relationship with these? And the first is humility. So that's very logical. One can't learn anything without some humility. Because if you think you already know, how can you learn? Or even in ordinary life, if you ask somebody, you know, how do I travel to Frankfurt? And they tell you, oh, that's not right. And how can you learn anything? How can you even have ordinary human relationships if you always think you know and you always think you're right? Right? There's a funny joke, right? I married Mr. Wright, but I didn't know his first name was Always. So that when we have false ego, we think like that. I'm always right. Everyone else is always wrong. I'm always better than anybody else. And in such a state, one can't learn anything. You can't even learn, you know, how to fix something or how to travel somewhere. What to speak of knowing about God, knowing about spiritual. But above just even knowledge, material or transcendental, can someone give Uttamasokapu a paper? Anyone who comes, if you can. Besides just that, we find that Mahaprabhu, of course, said, Trinadapi Samuchena Taro Ivasa Hishina, Amanida Manadena Kirtaniya Sadahari. If we really want to chant, if we actually want to chant and not just have a ritual of chanting, but if we want to enter into chanting actually, then we also have to be humble. And it's quite interesting that in Bhaktivinoda Thakur's Bhajana Rahasya, he equates this third verse of the Shikshastaka with the platform of nishta, or steadiness. And it's further interesting, the Srila Prabhupada says, until one reaches the stage of nishta, that spiritual life is a hard struggle with determination, and after the stage of nishta, everything comes much more easily and automatically. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur is giving the door to nishta as this Trinadapi verse. So if we don't develop humility, then where do we stay? We stay on the offensive platform of chanting, right? We can't really become free of our anartas, we can't really learn anything, and we never enter into the higher realms of bhakti. And indeed, it's possible for someone to stay in that place, as far as I can understand, for lifetimes if one wants to. It's possible for one to have a very beginning, ritualistic, arrogant experience in spiritual life for decades or lifetimes if one wants. There's not that Krishna is going to force one. You could say, well, Prabhupada says we will be dragged. Krishna will ultimately drag us to success. And I do see that Krishna puts us in situations where the most reasonable response to that situation is humility. But that doesn't mean that we have to become humble. Yes? Can you all understand my English? Am I speaking slowly enough? It's all right. But we've seen this many times. We've seen this certainly in other people, that Krishna puts them in a situation where humility is the most reasonable response to the situation, but that's not the response they have. Have we seen that? Yes? Someone is caught doing something really embarrassing, and you would think that they would respond with humility, and instead they respond with something else. They respond with defensiveness, they respond with, I'm always right, or something. If you could give that, Prabhu, a paper. Are there no more?
No more.
So it's not that Krishna is going to force us to be humble. Humility is always a choice. It's also interesting that in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, when Gopakumar comes all the way to Dwarka in the spiritual world, and he wants to go to Vrindavan, he's meeting with Uddhava and Narada, and he wants to go to Vrindavan. I find this fascinating that Narada Muni suggests that he goes to Jagannath Puri, which doesn't really make Uddhava very happy, because they're already in Dwarka, and Uddhava says, what's better about Jagannath Puri than Dwarka? And he's already in Dwarka. So Narada Muni says, yes, you're right. No need to go to Jagannath Puri. And then they say, well, if he goes to Jagannath Puri, he'll always be happy. And then how will he develop humility? And without humility, how will he develop prema? Now, I don't understand when they say happy here. That means that in order to be humble, you have to be sad. But in other words, he'll just be satisfied. He'll think, I don't need to do anything else. I already have everything that I need. And it's very nicely explained that prema and humility go together. That to whatever extent one develops humility, one develops prema. So pretty important, huh? I mean, without this humility, we're going to be stuck below nishta, in a hard struggle with determination. Does that sound like fun? No? I get a picture of somebody climbing a hill where there's no clear path and everything's full of thorns. And the problem with being in that stage, it's quite interesting factually that, you know, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur in Madhurya Kadambini, he doesn't list any anartas that are destroyed at Adushraddha or Sadhusanga. The anartas start being destroyed at Bhajanakriya. And of course, they're not really destroyed at Anistha Bhajanakriya. Anartha Nivritti starts happening when you do steady Bhajanakriya. And I think about how the Bhagavatam says that two people are happy, the fools and the transcendentalists. So until you start doing regular Bhajanakriya, my dear friends, we're basically a fool. Materialists are definitely fools. They think, yes, I'm happy. You know, Ishwaraham, Ahambogi, Siddham. I'm happy. I have my house. I have my car. You know, we were driven to the train station in a BMW yesterday. You know, I have my BMW. I have my beautiful wife, my handsome husband, my honor student children. I have some status in society. I'm happy. Of course, that's not actual happiness. That's more like a photograph. It's like, here's the photograph of my house and my wife and my children. See how happy I am? See? But a fool thinks like this, I am happy. And the transcendentalist is actually happy. So who's the person who's miserable? The person who's miserable is the person who realizes that material life is not happy, but isn't yet on the transcendental platform. Does that sound like a very nice place to be? No, it's not at all a nice place to be. And because we're Anandamaya Vyasat, because we're pleasure-seeking, it's not really a place we can stay for a very long time. The nature of the soul is to want happiness. So if we're no longer a fool, and you might say, what about the beginning transcendentalist? Are they a fool? Oh, yes. Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur says, such a person thinks, I am a transcendentalist. I am very advanced. I am almost a pure devotee. Practically speaking, I am a pure devotee. I have great love for Krishna. So, at Adushraddha and Sadhu Sangha and Anyastha Bhajana Kriya, one thinks, I am very spiritual. And before that, one thinks, I am a very successful materialist. Whereas one starts practicing steady Bhajana Kriya, one starts seeing, ooh, I am suffering. Now, it's also, Prabhupada says in the 20th chapter of Krishna book, that the materialists see the world as very aggressive, whereas to the devotees, even the material world is a very happy place. And when I said that quote to devotees, I get interesting response sometimes that a person will say, oh, I thought it was just the opposite. I thought the materialists think the world is a happy place, and the devotees see it as very aggressive. So if the devotees are seeing the world as aggressive, that means they're in this place where you have enough knowledge to see that the false ego brings suffering, but you're not yet advanced enough to be really tasting the bliss of Krishna consciousness. Now, of course, in this process given by Mahaprabhu, Kevala Nandakanda, even in that stage, there's happiness, but not the kind of happiness that the soul is seeking. So we find that many people take up Krishna consciousness seriously and then don't persist. And my own personal theory about this is that they get stuck for too long in this Anistha Bhajana Kriya, which is just, it's very unpleasant. It's really, really an unpleasant. As Shiva Ramar says, it's very unsatisfying. So if we would like to get to the stage where Krishna consciousness starts becoming natural and easy, we have to go through this door of humility. There's just no other door. It's the only door. There isn't another door. There's a famous book by a Christian called Pilgrim's Progress, written many, many centuries ago. And he talks about from the Bible how the path is narrow, the gate is very narrow. And in his story, there are people who try to get in by jumping over the gate, you know, or going around, but they don't make any progress. So that's not possible. That's what we call like the sahajiyas, who just, well, I'm not going to become humble, I'm just going to pretend I'm a gopi. You notice they always pretend that they're gopis? They never pretend their cowherd voice. Kind of interesting. So that doesn't work. You can't jump over the gate, you can't go under the gate, you can't go around the gate. You have to go through the gate of humility. I was once talking to one very advanced devotee in our movement, and I said, this door of humility looks to me like a door made out of fire. And she said, no, it's just a door. So at a certain point in my time in the Hare Krishna movement, I decided maybe it was time to start figuring out what this humility is. Now, because we all know it's important among our devotees of Krishna, we all pretend to be humble. It's one of the first things you learn when you join the Hare Krishna movement, is how to pretend to be humble. You know, would you like to cook? Oh, no, I'm not really very good at cooking. And inside you're thinking, I'm really good at cooking. I wonder when they're going to ask me. You know, well, I'm a really fallen devotee, Prabhu, and I'm full of material desires. And we have all kinds of what I call humility talk. And, of course, that's not real humility. For many years, I thought that that was just rubbish, all the humility talk. Although I did it also so I could not be thrown out of the Hare Krishna movement. And then I had some time working in the outside world as part of my degree, where people didn't even do humility talk. They didn't even pretend to be humble. And then I started appreciating that even the devotees pretending to be humble was something nice. Because at least it establishes that we know that humility is important. Even if it's a pretense. It sets the culture. Humility is important. So what in the world is humility? What is it? Why does it scare us so much? And what steps can we take to become humble? So if we look at Bhagavad Gita 13:18-12 in the purport where Prabhupada defines humility, he gives a very simple description. He says, humility means one should not be anxious to have the satisfaction of being honored by others. He's not saying we should never be honored by others. Sometimes we'll be honored by others, sometimes we won't. But we shouldn't want that satisfaction of, oh, I'm being honored by others. I am right.
I am good. I am better. I am the best. Now, in meditating on this and researching it, I came to the conclusion that we could separate humility into three characteristics. Now, I don't pretend that this is the ultimate analysis or the only right analysis, but I did find it to be very helpful. I found it very helpful in two ways. First of all, to give up my fears of humility, and second of all, to try to see what humility was so I could start to practice it. So let's look at our fears of humility. Why are we afraid of humility? Why don't we just do it? Some ideas?
Yeah, at this point I can't control, I can't enjoy, so I have to...
Oh, okay, I like that. If I give up my controlling propensity, how will I enjoy anything? I have to have a controlling propensity so I can manipulate the world for my enjoyment. I'll just be sad all the time. Right? Okay, what else are we afraid of? Nobody has any fears about humility? Yeah?
Personally, I'm feeling like to be the latest, the last, and to don't become enough or something like this.
That you'll be lost?
Yeah. For
this,
my ego.
I have to fight for what I need or I won't get what I need. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes?
Fear of being hurted by someone.
Oh, death, that's one of the biggest fears. That if I'm humble, I'll be hurt. And I'm sure we have experience that we take a humble position and people kick us. Yes? One of the most common interchanges among human beings. So this person offends this person. This person's angry. This person says, I'm sorry. Well, I'm so glad you're sorry. Now that you're sorry, let me tell you all the things I'm angry at. Yes? Has this happened? Have we experienced? Maybe we've done this also. So sometimes people take humility as an open door to kick you. Right? Oh, I made a mistake. I'm sorry. Oh, I'm so glad you said you're sorry. Wham, bam. So we have experience that if we show some weakness, right? If we show some humility, some vulnerability, then somebody says, oh, good, a weakness. Let me, you know, stab a knife into it. Actually, there was one Indian gentleman who's now a very wonderful devotee, who met Prabhupada many times in Bombay, and he never surrendered at that time, but much later. And he talks about how he was trained as a businessman to find other people's weaknesses and exploit them. So we have this fear that if I reveal my weaknesses, then I'll become exploited. Of course, I'm getting exploited anyway, but I figure if I show my weaknesses, I'll get exploited even more. Any other fears about humility? Yeah.
Well, I don't want to be seen as artificially humble.
Oh, okay. I don't want to be seen as artificially humble. I don't want people to think that I'm a pretender. We have a big fear of this in general in about spiritual life. Somebody gave me some water somewhere. Where did it go? Ah, there it is. I think we also may be afraid that it'll be really difficult. Really difficult or really painful in some way. Because we often try to just be a little bit humble and it's so hard. And we think if I did the whole thing, it might be really hard. So the first thing I looked at is that humility has got to be real. This idea of being a pretender, that humility's got to be real. It must be, because it's the behavior of those who are called the sattvatas. Satam prasangam, mamavirya sambhidam. The devotees are often called Sat or Satam. Krishna appeared in the dynasty of the Sattvikas. We have this word Sattva, meaning goodness, but also means truth. That which is real, that which is authentic. So often we see humility as being pretentious, as being something false. You know I'm a good cook, but I say, no, I'm not a good cook. I know every verse in the Bhagavad Gita, but I say, no, I'm not really a scholar. So this is, we think of humility like this, because when we do our play humility, that's usually the kind of things that we do. But humility couldn't possibly be something false. How could humility be a lie? I mean, it often seems like that to us in the songs of the Acharyas also. You know, Bhaktivinoda Thakur saying, I'm the most sinful of all sinners. And we read that and say, what? Huh? Or Krishna Das Kaviraj, I'm lower than Jaghai and Madhai. And again, we're just kind of scratching our head, isn't it? And saying Jaghai and Madhai were murderers, rapists, thieves, arsonists. Krishna Das Kaviraj didn't do any of that. He didn't kill anybody, rape anybody, burn down any building. And what is he talking about? And we think, if I have to say that, if I have to say, I'm the most sinful of all sinners, how could I mean that? I mean, you know, I'm not Stalin or Idi Amin or any of these guys, Saddam Hussein or Hitler. I mean, I'm not that, at least in this life. I mean, I didn't do anything like that. Anybody here? Anybody here murdered anybody? Rape, steal, arson. I mean, did we do that in this life? Probably not. Maybe I did it in some other life. I don't know. But it's very hard to say, what does that mean? So it seems to us that humility is some kind of pretense, but it can't be. It's impossible. How could somebody who's fully in the truth be lying about themselves? Is that possible? Is that possible?
No.
No, impossible. So it must be authentic. It's got to be real. All right, so what is the reality of our humility? Well, the first reality of our humility is that we're extremely small. I mean, we're so small, it's almost absurd how small we are. You know, if you take an airplane and fly over Germany, you have to get really close to the ground to see this building. And it's really not until you're almost landing that you see people. I mean, people are so small. We're really, really small. And our impact on things, you know, people like to pretend that they have a really big influence on the earth, but the fact is that when we die, life will go on exactly as it's going on now. The world will not collapse when we die. It just won't. And it wasn't collapsing before we were born. It wasn't that everything's a mess and, you know, and my work is so important. It's just not like that. And I use the example all the time that how many people remember the names of their great-great-grandparents? Prabhupada talks about this in the seventh canto in relationship to Prahlad getting the benediction that 21 generations of his ancestors would be liberated. And Prabhupada says, we know our grandfather, maybe our great-grandfather. So we can only liberate those generations whom we know. And therefore, this 14 generations must refer to many lifetimes. It's quite interesting. In other words, we liberate people who have an attachment for us and to whom we have an attachment. Not just some random family member. So I've asked thousands of people all over the world who can name all of their great-great-grandparents, and I found maybe 10 or 20 people. Which means that our great-great-grandchildren will have forgotten our names. Oh, that's my grandson. That means his grandchildren will have forgotten my name. What to speak of all the important things that I'm doing? They're gone. So that's the truth. The truth is that we're very insignificant. Our own family members will not remember our name. Pretty amazing, huh? I mean, if you're a really, really important person, maybe your name will be in the history book for 1,000 years, and some child in school will suffer over memorizing it. You know, oh, What did Napoleon do again? What year did he live? Okay, write it on the exam. You know, if you're really, really, really important, you get a couple paragraphs in the newspaper. So that's the truth. That's the truth. We're not very important. We're very, 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 very small. Now, that's a very liberating truth. Because if I'm not very important, I don't have to pretend that I'm very important. Pretense is a burden, isn't it? Yes. Raghunath Das Goswami talks about pretense as the main problem in Manushiksha with attaining higher realms of bhakti. So pretense is the opposite of humility. I'm pretending that I'm very important. Even there was one devotee who stood up to ask Prabhupada a question. I'm sure you've heard this story. And he said, Srila Prabhupada, I am the most fallen. That's how he started his question. And Prabhupada said, you're not the most anything. Sit down. Or another famous story was when a devotee wrote a letter to Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada, I have a very big problem. And he went to describe his problem. And he signed the letter, your most insignificant servant. And Prabhupada was laughing and laughing. And he turned to Shruti Kirti and he said, just see, how can an insignificant person have a big problem? So it's a relief. I'm very small, I'm very insignificant. Of course, I'm very important to Krishna. I'm very, very important to Krishna. Very important to Krishna. There's nobody exactly like me. Each jiva is unique. And there's no one who has my particular relationship with Krishna. So to Krishna, I'm extremely important. But from an objective point of view, I'm very unimportant. And everything I have is really Krishna's, other than my free will. Everything. The clothes I have, are they mine? Do our clothes belong to us? Does our body belong to us? Our memory? Our knowledge? Our talents? Our money? Our shoes? Our home? Our room, our little box of stuff, whatever we have. Is it ours? Is it ours? How do we know it's not ours? What's the evidence that it's not ours? It can be taken away, yes? How quickly? Instantly. And does Krishna need to ask our permission? Excuse me, may I take your memory away? Does he need to ask our permission? No. Excuse me, are you finished with your body now? Can I have it back? Does he have to ask? Does he have to give a warning even? Does he have to have somebody say, you know, in 7 days you'll die? No, he can just take it. He can take everything, and he will take everything. So how is it ours? So what is what I have to be proud of? How can I be proud of somebody else's thing? Now, I could be proud of the somebody else. Just see what a great master I have. But how can I be personally proud of it? It's absurd. So if I had some beautiful painting in my room, you said, oh, what a beautiful painting. I can say, yes, this is done by my friend. Isn't he a wonderful artist? So if someone says, oh, you're so clever, you're so good at this, you're so good at this. Isn't Krishna wonderful? But how do I have any credit for it? What credit do I have? I mean, I think it's so humorous that even people say, oh, you have beautiful hair, and you say thank you, as if you created it. No, it just always amuses me. People even say that about their dog, huh? Oh, what a nice looking dog. Oh, thank you very much. Like I created the dog, you know. So if I really understand, this is very practical, because if I really understand that everything I so-called have is Krishna's, then I will use it in his service. That's real practical humility. Humility isn't just the attitude that it's not mine, it's Krishna's. Humility is practical. I use it for Krishna because it's Krishna's. Very practical demonstration of humility. And how can we be proud even of our spiritual advancement? Can Krishna test us beyond our limits? Do each of us have a limit? I think so. Right? Like Haridas Thakur had all of Maya come before him, Maya Devi herself. And he's like, why don't you chant Hare Krishna? But most of us, if all of Maya Devi came before us, there's something that would interest us, huh? Ooh. So even our ability to stay in Krishna consciousness is that Krishna doesn't do that to us. He protects us. Krishna says, my devotee will never perish. Sometimes Krishna tests someone beyond their limit as a way to bring them to their senses. That I'm not doing this on my own. So someone in humility doesn't say they're poor if they're rich, but they say this is Krishna's money that I use it in his service. They don't say they're ugly when they're beautiful, but they say this is Krishna's beauty I'm using in his service. That's honesty. Honesty is, I am so insignificant, I am so unimportant, my effect on the world is practically zero. As Haridas Thakur said, if an insect like me dies, what is the loss? But Krishna is so kind, he's engaging me in his service and allowing me to do something that's spiritually important to please him. How wonderful my Lord is. Krishna's given me so many talents, so many abilities, so much knowledge, so much strength. How wonderful my Lord is. Let me use this in his service. So that is humility. Does that sound really awful? No, and that's the truth. And the truth is very liberating. The truth gives us peace. I don't have to pretend it's mine. I don't have to pretend that I'm dependent on it for my happiness. I don't have to pretend that I'm great. I don't have to pretend that I'm important. I can be who I am. Isn't that nice? Doesn't everybody want to be who they are? Well, who am I? I'm a little tiny servant who Krishna loves very, very much, and who Krishna, out of his kindness, has given so many gifts to use for him. Isn't Krishna wonderful? Am I wonderful? Well, Krishna thinks I'm wonderful, but that's his kindness. That's his love. Just like the mother and father, they always think their baby is cute. Some babies are really cute, but a lot of babies are not really cute. Some babies are cute. But the parents always think their baby is cute. Right? Always. That's their love. So Krishna always thinks each of us is wonderful. And of course, because we're part of him, we are wonderful. We are spiritually wonderful. We have most of the qualities of God. We can't breathe out universes, but we're full of kindness and beauty, right? And strength. We're wonderful linguists and clever. And most of the qualities of God are also our qualities because we're part of him. So therefore you have... If you read carefully Krishna Das Kaviraj in his, you know, really heavy, heart-wrenching, humble section of I'm lower than Jagai and Mudhai, you know, I'm lower than the worm and stool, if you say my name, you'll become sinful. There's just about three verses like that within 17 verses. And in those 17 verses, he's, I got the mercy of Lord Nityananda. I got the mercy of Madan Mohan. Wow! It's a celebration. He's celebrating. So this is a little secret. This is a little secret. So one becomes actually very peaceful. What we'll do first, grateful. One becomes very grateful. Because if I'm very small, and yet Krishna loves me, and Krishna's given me so many things, I become very grateful. And this is Krishna Das Kaviraj's mood, that he's very grateful. So I think it's a very simple idea. You know, if you have 5 euros and you go to the store and you buy something that's worth 5 euros, how do you feel? Okay, right? You have 5 euros, you go to the store, you buy something, and someone says, oh, you can get that for 1 euro at that store. Then how do you feel? Right? You have 5 euros, you go to the store, and you buy something, you find out it's worth 100 euros. How do you feel?
Wow.
I figured this out on my 45th birthday when the devotees at the temple where I lived had a huge party for me that I didn't expect. And I felt so grateful because I didn't expect it at all. I didn't feel that I deserved it. And that's when I figured out that our happiness is in direct proportion to our gratitude, which is in direct proportion to our feeling of not deserving. As soon as I feel I deserve, then I don't enjoy anything. Isn't it? If I have this list, this is the modern consciousness of rights. If I have this list of these are my rights, this is what I deserve, then anything less than what I deserve makes me angry. No matter how nice it is. I mean, it can be incredibly nice, but if it's less than what I deserve, I'm not happy. And if it's exactly what I deserve, eh. And this is what damages so many relationships. Right? The man is working hard and the woman says, well, you're my husband, you're supposed to work hard. Right? The woman cooks delicious meals and the husband says, well, you're my wife, you're supposed to cook delicious meals. And so there's no pleasure in it. So our pleasure is related to our gratitude completely. And our gratitude is relating to feeling that I deserve nothing. And we're afraid if I think I deserve nothing that I'll get nothing. But that's ridiculous. We all get so many things, isn't it? Who gets nothing? Even there was this this gentleman who recently died in Vrindavan. And for like 30 years, he just lived on the parikrama path by the Krishna Balaram tree. And this man really had nothing. I mean, talk about nothing. Sometimes devotees say, oh, Krishna took everything away. And I'm like, can you walk? But this man, he had no possessions at all. He lived by the side of the road. And still he was taken care of. He wasn't very skinny. He had lots of friends. You know, he was very happy. So he got everything. Why would we not get everything just because we think we don't deserve? Krishna's not giving us things because we deserve them. He's giving us things because he loves us. That's pretty simple. The parents don't take care of the child because the child deserves to be taken care of. You know, the little baby hasn't earned it or something. But just out of love. And Krishna enjoys. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says in relationship to 922 in Bhagavad Gita, Yoga Kshema Vahamyaham, that Krishna enjoys taking care of his devotees. He doesn't see it as a burden. So the devotees then, they feel so much love for the Lord and so much gratitude. Wow, Krishna is so wonderful. I'm so small, I'm so insignificant, but still he notices me. Not, well, I'm great, of course he notices me. I mean, of course God should notice me. I mean, I'm the most important person on the most important planet in the most important universe. And but then there's no happiness. But if I'm really like a speck of dust on a speck of dust of the planet, on a speck of dust in the universe, and a speck of dust in creation, that if I died tomorrow, you know, within a couple of weeks, everybody would forget about me. Really? And still, Krishna notices me. Doesn't Krishna notice each of us? Yes? Do you ever have some little desire and Krishna just fulfills it? Has that ever happened to you?
Yeah.
You know, I tell the story about how I was, many years ago, I was looking in my closet and I thought, I could use one more silk sari for festivals. I think I'd like it to be a heavy beige with an embroidered border, and that'd be really nice. Maybe I'll get it when I go to India. Oh, it'll be at least $40. I don't need to spend $40 on a sari. I already have two silk saris. That's enough. So that was like a 20-second thought. And then I forgot about it. And 3 days later, some devotee came up to me and, Amrul, I have something for you. And she handed me that sari as if it had been custom made to my specifications. And I felt so embarrassed. I'm like, Krishna, I'm so sorry. So, but he noticed me, yes? He noticed. There's some little jiva in the four-headed Brahma's universe, in the Milky Way galaxy, in the solar system, on the Earth planet, in America, who wants a beige sari with an embroidered border. That's amazing. So that's humility. I'm so small, but Krishna notices me. notices me even for little things like that. Even, frankly, for stupid things like that. You know, some piece of cloth. You know, like when I first moved in the temple, I remember looking at the Maha Suites, which, you know, were put away after Mangalarti, thinking, I'd really like one of those burfis. And 2 seconds later, someone comes up and, here, would you like this burfi? You know, Krishna's noticed me. So whatever we have, whether it's, you know, our chatter or our shoes or our memory or our talents or whatever, our friends, and we feel, humility makes us feel grateful, and then those things bring us great joy. Not great joy like the materialist, here's something for me to enjoy, but wow, how wonderful Krishna is. That we feel that the love between ourselves and Krishna. Now you can say, well, all right, that refers to the good things, but what about the bad things? So humility also makes us feel peaceful with the bad things, because we see that there really isn't anything bad. You know, again, this concept of bad comes from this, I deserve. I deserve something good. One devotee was just saying this to me in Munich. You know, oh, there are so many people who are evil and cruel, and they have lots of money, and I'm a devotee, and I'm poor. You know, and then she looked at me and she said, that's envy, isn't it? I said, yeah, it is. But we feel like this. Now, why am I suffering? Why did I stick my finger in the blender? I'm a good devotee, you know. I was just trying to cook for Krishna. Why am I going through suffering? But if we really see that we're very small and very fallen, then we're peaceful with the difficulties. We understand that the difficulties are really Krishna just trying to help us. Now, in order to really be peaceful with the difficulties, I don't know how to say this, so it's not too heavy. We have to see ourselves very honestly. And again, I believe that this is one of the main reasons why people either don't stay in Krishna consciousness or stay superficially. Because in order to go through Anistha Vajna Kriya to Nistha Vajna Kriya, in order to go through that door of humility, one has to see one's anartas. There's just no other way around it. It's not, you can't say, well, I'm just going to go on pretending I don't have any problems. One has to see that one's heart is full of lust, anger, envy, greed, and illusion. And it's not very pretty. You know, there was one devotee who was complaining to me about another devotee in the temple. Oh, that devotee had service to do, and she just left and went somewhere without telling anybody. And how can she do that? They're taking so much care of her at the temple. And how can she be on and on and on and on and on about how terrible this other devotee was? And finally I looked at her and I said, you know, what you're doing is evil. She said, it's evil? I said, yeah, it's evil. I said, you're being so critical is just as bad as this devotee being irresponsible. Oh, why? I said, because it's full of pride. Oh, I didn't know I was pride. I was prideful. So we don't see ourselves honestly. We often think that our anartas are artas. I always use the example of someone who has like a pet python, you know, or a pet tiger or something. Oh, my nice pet. And then it's in the newspaper. Man doesn't show up to work for 5 days, and they go to his apartment and they find a very full and satisfied python. With the man's shoes on the floor. So this is what we're doing with there's many things we look at and we say, oh, look at this wonderful quality of mine. Look at this jewel. Here, Krishna, take this jewel. And he's looking at it and going, that's not a jewel. It's poo. So one of the ways that we have to advance is we have to see honestly what's in our heart. What is good and what is not good. What is actual love and what is loss. What is service and what is envy. And we have to be willing to let go of the anartas. And if we see honestly, then we're going to be peaceful with the purification. Just like I have one friend whose husband was diagnosed with a very rare form of cancer at a very young age. And to get rid of the cancer, he had to go through a horrible treatment, just horrible. Frankly, I probably would have rather died. Unbelievably horrible treatment. So why was he willing to suffer? Because he was convinced that he had a terrible disease. You understand? The doctor showed him he had a soft spot in his skull. His wife noticed it one time. She was massaging her husband's head, and she said, "Why is it soft over there?" And he found that he had a brain tumor. And he was so scared of the disease that he was willing to undergo very, very painful treatment for a very long time. And he was grateful for the treatment. So if we can do that for ordinary things, huh? If we actually see how much evil is in our heart, then we'll be grateful for Krishna removing the evil, even if it means he sometimes uses a knife. By the way, he will never use a knife if we let him do it pleasantly, is my experience. He only uses a knife if we're really stubborn. So then we're peaceful. Now, I'm the one who got this anartha. I'm the one who brought this python into my house. I'm the one who fed the python. I'm the one who petted the python. And, you know, if you have to take the door off the hinges to get my big fat python out of the house, then I feel peaceful with that. I'm not like, what are you doing with my door? And so that's also humility. Giving up this rights mentality, giving us this deserve mentality. I find it very interesting. One famous Christian writer, C.S. Lewis, in his book Screwtape Letters, which is a favorite of Arvinda Saru Prabhu and Jai Dwaita Swami, so I don't mind saying it's also one of my favorites. He talks about how we think, my time belongs to me. My life belongs to me. My time belongs to me. We get so resentful if anybody takes up our time with something that was different than what we had planned. So this is also being peaceful, especially those of us who are initiated. We already said, hey, my time belongs to you. Like Mahaprabhu told Sanatana Goswami when he wanted to commit suicide, he said, what are you doing wanting to destroy somebody else's property? So time, kalosmi, my time belongs to Krishna. I always find it amusing when somebody talks to me about something and they say, so Urmila, I'm so sorry for taking your time. It's like, I didn't create time. I don't say that. I just say, no, it's all right. But I'm always thinking, I didn't create time. It's not my time. I have no control over how much time I have, how long I'm in this body, and how much health I have. And it's Krishna's time. It's meant to be used however Krishna wants me to use it. And if Krishna thinks that the best use of my time is being with you, then that's the best use of my time. How am I to determine what's most important for me to do? That's Krishna's business. And then one's peaceful. One's peaceful with what Krishna does with one's time. One's peaceful with what Krishna does with one's body, with one's wealth, with one's life. Because we know I have a loving friend and I don't deserve anything. And everything Krishna's doing is out of love. So just some practical tips for developing this humility is, first of all, confront our fears about it and look at the great devotees like Srila Prabhupada, Rupa Goswami, Sanatana Goswami, and see, were they experiencing these fears? Was Prabhupada always being stepped on and abused? Was he a pretender? And we see that the saints who are actually humble, they don't have all these problems that we're afraid of. And realize that all humility is peacefulness and gratitude and joyfulness and authenticity, all the things that we want. Now, there's really nothing painful about it at all. Really, keeping up pretense and pretending to be something that we're not and trying to fool everybody else is really burdensome and painful. And of course, nobody else is really fooled anyway. Just like we can see everybody else's faults, yes? At least I'm very good at seeing everybody's faults. Yes, you can all see other people's faults? So you know what? Everybody can see ours too. They already know them, and pretending we don't have them is really foolish. And Krishna can already see all of our faults too. Who are we pretending? Who are we fooling? So we seem like that and give up our fears about humility. Some really practical things is to meditate on how small we are and how wonderful Krishna is. that whenever we find ourselves getting into a rights mentality, I deserve this, to look at it honestly and say, you know, all I deserve is to exist. That's the only thing I really deserve. And I'm just so grateful for Krishna's love, and any way he uses me is wonderful. Another thing I found really helpful is to give up defending that we're right. It's amazing how much energy the conditioned soul wastes in trying to defend that they're right. It's unbelievable. Almost every argument is, I'm right, no, I'm right, no, I'm right, no, I'm right, and you're wrong, and I'm right, and I'm right, and you're wrong. And it's so absurdly stupid. And we will argue, even to the point of violence and wars, about, you know, where the line is drawn in the earth as to which side is, you know, who has how many kilometers of dirt to call belonging to their country. I mean, what a thing to argue about. And kill each other over. I'm right. And people will argue for generations, isn't it? They'll fight each other for generations. My land. No, it's my land. No, it's my land. No, I was right. People get divorced over this. No, I did put the spoons away. No, you didn't. Yes, I did. No, you didn't. I did. You never put the spoons away. But I did put them away. I'm leaving you. I hate you. And we do this. So we say, well, can't I defend my ego when I am right? And then we have to ask ourselves, why do I want to defend my ego? Isn't that what I joined the Hare Krishna movement to get rid of? You know, so I came in the door and I said, would you please help me get rid of my false ego and awaken my real ego? Okay, sure, take this process. And then we want to defend our false ego. Poor Krishna, he's probably just going, you know. And we say to Krishna, help me get rid of this thing, and then we're feeding it. Do you want me to get rid of it or not? You know, if the guys came to take away the python, and you're like, no, I want to feed it. They're like, what do you want me to do here? So Krishna's not going to force our false ego out of our hands. He will reveal how nasty it is, but he won't force it out of our hands. So if someone says, you're a stupid fool, you know, it's all right to say, you're right, I'm a stupid fool. Oh, you made a mistake. Okay, I made a mistake. Oh, but if I admit I made a mistake, maybe they'll throw me out of the temple. So they throw you out of the temple. So you end up lying on the street. You can still be happy, like that man in the Parikrama path. And as I said, everybody knows our faults anyway. It's not like a surprise to anybody else. Now, there are some people you can't admit your fault to. There are some really nasty people that if you ever admit your fault, they'll kick you in the head. So therefore, there was that snake that was a disciple of Narada. And Narada told him to stop biting. And then Narada came back and says, how are you doing? And he said, well, the children are throwing stones at me. He said, well, then don't bite, but raise your hood. So there are some people who, if they say to you, you're a nasty, envious, low demon, and you say, you're right, then for the next 20 years, they'll say, you even admitted you were a nasty, envious demon. And they'll be very uncomfortable. So with those people, better just to be silent. But with other people, you can say, you're right. I'm a nasty, envious, low demon. Okay, next. What else would you like to do? Why did you do this? I'm sorry. I'll try to do better next time. Very simple. It's not really a very complicated thing. And once one starts to practice that, one starts to become aware of how much of our human shakti we spend on defending our false ego and trying to prove to everybody that we're important, that we're right, that we're good, that we have good motives. Oh, we spend a lot of time trying to prove to people that we have good motives. Maybe I did something wrong, but I had good motives. And just let it go. So everybody thinks I have evil motives. I do have evil motives, so now they know. Oh, well. Maybe they won't love me anymore. No, they probably never really loved me anyway. It's really only Krishna who loves me. Just peel away all the pretense. Just peel it away and be real. and be authentic. Again, not that you have to write something on the internet and reveal to everybody all the bad thoughts you ever had in your life. Nobody wants to read that anyway. That's not necessary. No, but just let the false ego die. Let the Ishwaraham aham bogi siddaham, let it die. All it was an enemy anyway. All it was a block anyway. All it is doing is keeping us from entering the higher stages of bhakti. It's just like a big octopus blocking the door to higher levels of bhakti. So if you starve it and let it die, what is the harm? So we have on your paper a little plan, and you might want to do that on your own, a little plan as to how I'm going to work on humility. What will it feel like? What will I be feeling? What will I be thinking? And what will I be doing? That's at the bottom of the paper. And to examine, this is something that you can do on your own, to examine your own personal fears about humility. It's very, very helpful, by the way, to articulate and face our fears about things. Because Maya gives us these very vague fears, like a shadow in a closet at night. Ooh, this will happen. And when you get them out in the sunshine and you look at them, then you see they're really nothing. So it's good to bring out our fears about humility and have some very specific feelings, thinking, feeling, willing, some very specific feelings, thoughts, and behaviors. And you could even take a vow, you know, a 3-day vow. Okay, for the next 3 days, if anyone said I did something wrong, I'm just going to say, okay, how can I fix it? Even if they're wrong. Even if I'm right. You know, for the next 3 days, I'm going to just really be grateful for everything that Krishna's given me. I'm going to meditate on how wonderful Krishna's gifts are. Or I'm going to read the sections. Especially I like it, Chaitanya Charitamrita. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, when Mahaprabhu gives him the prasadam early in the morning. And he also says, you've turned a crow into Garuda. And to see that humility is both of these things together. I'm so low and Krishna is so wonderful. I'm so low and Krishna is so wonderful. I'm so low and the devotees are so wonderful. They're so merciful. They're so kind. How lucky I am! And to meditate, read and meditate on these sections of humility so we really become attracted to them. So questions, comments, additions, subtractions? Yes, brother.
Humility is one of the items of Sharanagati. As it is presented in Chaitanya Charitamrita, it's the final item. But when Bhaktivinoda Thakur sings his introductory song to Sharanagati, he starts with...
It was the first time.
Danya, Magnitana, etc. So, any comment on that?
Well, I'm thinking if that's another thing that we could do, is you could meditate on those songs of Sharanagati, learn those songs and memorize those songs. My comment on that is that Krishna also starts knowledge with humility. It's the first item in knowledge in 13:8-12. So there has to be at least some humility just to get started. Without some humility, I mean, you can do Arushraddha and Sadhusanga without any humility. But there's no way that you can start an Arjanavritti without some humility. You just can't. It's impossible. You can't. You'll just spin your wheels. I see people get stuck in what I call an anarta loop, which is where they're like they see their anartas, but they're too afraid to give them up because of pride. So they're vacillating between the seeing it and pride, and they go a little crazy. Or people who see their anartas and then run away and go back to being materialists or just become superficial devotees. So without some humility. Now that's not deep stuff. That humility to go through an Arjanavritti, that's not really deep stuff, although it feels very deep to the person at the time. But it's required in the very beginning. And at the end, humility is there, but that humility that's at the end, I don't know if I can talk about that, Prabhu. That's a really deep thing. You know, I can talk about that only in a very theoretical way. I try not to preach theoretically. And I can only talk about that theoretically. I mean, what kind of humility is it that the residents of Vrindavan, that Krishna leaves and says, I'm coming right back, and he doesn't, and they still love him. You know, I just sort of look at it and go, wow. That's the last verse of the Shikshastika. So you can see that's another example that you have humility at two places in the Shikshastika. You have it in the third verse, which is Nishta. And then you have it in the last verse. So I don't really think I could talk about the last verse of the Shikshastika, except to say that there is a very deep humility, and it must be really sweet. From my position, it looks quite scary, but it must be really, 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 really sweet. It must be amazing, that humility. Is that all right?
Yeah, thank you.
I'm just thinking the Spanish Catholic saint, Teresa of Avila, who lived at the time of Mahaprabhu, in her book Interior Mansions, which seems to be describing vikarma to prema, madhurya prema also. And she talks about intense humility toward the end. And she says, I know this couldn't be coming from the devil, because the devil cannot give such exquisite pain. And she said, this is a pain that makes all material pains disappear. And it's such a perfect and beautiful pain that you long for it and want nothing else. And we have in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, where Gopakumar is asked by the Mathura Brahmana, when Krishna goes to Mathura, why don't you also go to Mathura? Why do you stay in Vrindavana in separation? And he says, this pain dances on the head of all other happiness. And this is someone who experienced the greatest happiness on earth as a king, the happiness in Swarga, the happiness in Maharloka, the happiness in Tapaloka, in Brahmaloka, the happiness of all the layers of the universe, the happiness in Vaikuntha, the happiness in Ayodhya, the happiness in Dwarka. And he says this deep humility, that this pain of deep humility at the end, that it dances on the heads of all other happiness. I was just reading just yesterday on the train where Rupa Goswami says that it's not everyone can even appreciate that sweetness. So that kind of deep humility is also experienced to different degrees depending on a person's rasa. So those in Vaikuntha do not experience that as deeply as those in Goloka. Those in Vaikuntha have a little bit more sense that I have Swarupya City. I have Sarshti City. Like that. I have Samipya City. They have a little of that. And even in Dwarka. I was just reading Rupa Goswami say, even in Dwarka, the queens are, you know, they have a little, there's something. I'm Krishna's queen. You know, I'm to Vrindavan. And then, of course, the limit being the gopis. That I'm nothing. I'm absolutely nothing. I mean, it's, you know, for us, again, it's a little scary. But like Sanatana Goswami explains, that each of the cowherd boys thinks, I'm Krishna's favorite. And each of the cowherd boys is Krishna's favorite. It's true. He said, but each of the gopis thinks, I'm not even the least. I'm not even in the group. I'm nothing. When will I be the least? I mean, even Radharani's thinking like that. All the other devotees are better than me. Krishna, as Kaviraj says, he feels 10 million times more happiness when Krishna enjoys with one of the other gopis than with her. Because she's thinking, they're so much more qualified than me. So, I can repeat from the Shastra. I can do that. But I can't say I have any realization. Sorry. Could ask somebody else, perhaps. Anybody else? Thank you. That's a wonderful point.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Shri Prabhupada ki jai.